I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush wrapped up his five-day European tour today with a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Bratislava, Slovakia. At the conclusion of their three-hour meeting, Bush had these words for the waiting press.
It's very important that we establish not only a working relationship, but that we understand that in the 21st century, strong countries are built by developing strong democracies. And so we talked about democracy.
President Bush speaking today with what could be seen as a jab at Russian leader Vladimir Putin after their talks. Joining us on the line from Berlin is Constance Stetzenmüller. She's international security editor for the German weekly Die Zeit. And Constance, both of these men have claimed to personally like each other. But while President Bush has been talking about spreading democracy, Vladimir Putin is seen as attempting to roll it back in Russia and places like Ukraine. It doesn't sound as if Bush backed away from those differences.
Hello, I'm sorry, I'm losing you on the
line.
Oh,
that's too bad. Constance, I was just asking you, we heard President Bush saying that he was very firm with Vladimir Putin, saying that strong countries have strong democratic principles. It doesn't sound as if he backed away from that issue.
Hi, I'm sorry, we still have a problem because I'm getting another line in. I apologize for this being live, but now I can't hear you. I did get the question, though.
Go ahead.
I think what President Bush has to negotiate here is a very difficult tightrope act, really, between staying the course and principle with a very justified demand of asking Russia to moderate its course toward authoritarianism, its suppression of media rights, its suppression of democratic structures and civil rights. And at the same time, America's very real interests in energy supply diversification, for which, of course, energy and oil and gas, Russia is a prime source. So I think what you're having at the same time is a moderation of the tone, while keeping in mind we do want you to stay the course on democratization and making deals, and also seeing that work together as possible on crucial issues such as the Middle East.
Well, you mentioned making deals. Before the meeting, Russian and American officials announced an agreement to keep nuclear weapons and shoulder-fired rockets out of the hands of terrorists. Could you elaborate on some of the other things you've heard that the leaders talked about?
Well, I think the issue of shoulder-fired weapons is an important one because there is a serious proliferation problem there, and it is indeed coming out of Russia and the former Soviet republics. And if it is possible for the Russians to try and control that, that in itself would be a significant gesture of cooperation. That said, there are a number of far more crucial issues where even if America is not in a position to need Russia's cooperation, it would certainly be very bad if Russia actively opposed American efforts. And those are Iran, those are Iraq, and those are the peace process in the Middle East. And there have been hints out of Moscow to the effect of Putin maneuvering for a countervailing role for Russia in the Middle East. That would be very bad, both for Europe and for America.
Well, let's review this whole five-day visit, since it ends today. Beyond that phrase, fence mending with allies, and beyond deals like the shoulder-fired missiles and how to deal with Iran, what is the bigger geostrategic story that you see here?
Well, the bigger geostrategic story is that the transatlantic rift caused by the Iraq war and the diplomatic conflict around it has perhaps not become more shallow, but both sides are chastened, as in fact Senator John McCain said a couple days ago at a conference in Munich. It's very clear that both sides, both in Washington and in Europe and in my country, Germany as well, have done a rethink, have realized that they have made errors in style and in substance, and that they will need each other to work on some issues together. There, on issues like reconstructing Iraq, on preventing Iran from going nuclear, on keeping the peace process in the Middle East on course, there's a very, very narrow bandwidth for people to work together, and a lot of opportunities for disastrous mistakes. And we've seen in the last 3 years how disastrous that can be. Nobody wants that to happen again. That said, there are a lot of fundamental differences are still there under the surface.
And Constance, one last question in the few seconds we have. President Bush was greeted warmly in the town square in Slovakia, especially when he compared their velvet revolution that toppled communism in Slovakia, then a part of Czechoslovakia, with Iraq's modern-day revolution. But in general, how was he greeted by people?
Well, in Slovakia, people perceive America as a long time, a decades-long supporter of their search for freedom. I think that's very legitimate. That said, I think there is also criticism in Eastern Europe of the war in Iraq and the course that's taken. As you know, many Eastern countries are withdrawing their forces in Iraq wholly or partially because of pressure from home. And yes.
Constance, thank you so much. Constance Stenson-Mueller is the international security editor for the German weekly Die Zeit. We apologize for the line, Constance, and thank you. Well, this year marks the centennial year of the National Audubon Society. That name, Audubon, has become so synonymous with birds that younger people in particular might be forgiven for forgetting there is a man behind that name. And what a man. John James Audubon is the subject of a new biography by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Rhodes, and we recently welcomed him to our studio. And congratulations. Some are saying your second Pulitzer might be on its way.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
To this book. But would we, to
I think it's Bob Dylan this year, actually.
Well, to remind listeners, not bad company, the Pulitzer you won was for your The Making of the Atomic Bomb, of course, the story of Oppenheimer. From Oppenheimer to Audubon.
Yes.
Why?
Well, let's see, they're both Americans, and that's really an important reason. I mean, I've always been fascinated with how this country came together and how we became who we are. So in a way, they both fit. What's different, of course, is that I'm writing in another century.
Well, in fact, and some have said that the story of Audubon, who landed on these shores actually from France,
yes,
in
1803, right,
is the story of America.
Well, you know, he and his wife, Lucy, who was English and who arrived about the same time he did, are part of a generation of Americans that one historian has called the first generation of Americans. And in the course of their lives and the way they lived and the decisions they made, they really developed what we think of as the American character.
Right.
Individualism, optimism, entrepreneurial ambitions, those qualities, all of which, of course, Audubon had in excess, really.
And let's remind listeners of what he arrived with. He was born of his father's mistress in Haiti, adopted by his father's wife, just
yes,
in time to go to France for the French Revolution.
Yes, yes.
And then came here as a young boy, right as Lewis and Clark were departing for the West.
Right.
What more did you find out about him?
Well, as an 18-year-old, when he arrived here in 1803, he spoke no English. He had yellow fever within days of his arrival and was kept and taken care of by two Quaker ladies at a boarding house, and they taught him Quaker English. So for the rest of his life, this quintessential American woodsman spoke Quaker English with a heavy French accent.
But he's ours.
But he's ours,
he was,
yes,
ultimately, as you said, American.
So he married this young woman, and they went west. I think what's special about Audubon is, of course, his art. His writing, much more so than people seem to realize. The first essay that Thoreau published in a New England journal in 1843 opened with a tribute to Audubon's writing about the wilderness and about the natural world.
What was it about birds that captivated him? You write that he set out with a goal. He had a very clear goal. What was that, and why birds?
You know, trying to track that, there are a lot of references in his writing to the trauma of his childhood, not only the revolution, the loss of his mother when he was 6 months old, the terror that came to Nantes where he was growing up, and it resulted in the public slaughter of thousands of people. He lived through
in France.
He lived through a lot of trauma. And just after that, his father would be taking him for walks in the woods along the Loire River, downriver from Nantes. He had a mentor, a doctor named D'Orbigny, whose two sons both became famous French naturalists. And Audubon's uniqueness as an artist is that he, for the first time, recognized this collection of species of birds as having complex lives. He recognized their passions and their hunger and their desire and all the qualities that people at that time, people thought of birds in those days the way we think of fish, almost as feeling no pain. So he gave us a different view of the animate wilderness that I think, was really the beginning of the modern conservation and environmental values about the wilderness.
He captured America in drawing its birds, and the New York Times review of your book says that Audubon's birds are weirdly anthropomorphic. The white pelican looks like it might consult a pocket watch before flying. And it's true. And by the way, you can go to our website. We'll have many of Audubon's paintings on the website so you can look at them as you listen. But he gave them something that previously they didn't have, which was personality.
Yes, yes, exactly. Birds before Audubon were depicted as lumps standing on a branch, basically. And suddenly he made them alive. He made them flying and diving and swimming and loving and nesting and defending themselves.
Talk a little bit about how he did that, because his technique was completely his own as well.
It was. It took him a long time. People who know nothing else about Audubon often know that he shot the birds that he drew. They often hold that against him, but they forget that there were no cameras in those years. The only way he could make a bird stand still, unfortunately, was to shoot it. And then, within 24 hours, typically, he did a complete drawing and a watercolor wash over the drawing. And then, and this is indicated in a biography of birds that he wrote to go along with the Birds of America, he typically ate the bird. So at very least, he was frugal with his collections in that sense.
Right.
But the point is, he said even the color of the feathers would change within 24 hours of death. It was important to him to show these birds in their full living richness and complexity. And I think that's really the way we've come to understand the natural world.
Yeah. There are a lot of people who respond to his need to somehow have nature. And, of course, you can't have a bird, you know, in your hand.
Yes.
It's usually, you know, only a dead bird. But, you know, to collect stones and to collect bits and pieces, and he wanted it.
He did. In a way, he was in the middle of the transition from being a hunter to being a scientist. Scientists, very classically, Robert Oppenheimer, a good example, collect things as children.
Did you see a connection between Oppenheimer and Audubon?
I hadn't made that connection before, but it is there. Only he continued the collecting part, but then his work was somehow to transform what he collected into a representation that would convey to us, the viewer, that this creature had a life.
Can you think of some?
I think most dramatically, a story that I tell at length in the book was the golden eagle. He wrestled with that bird for a week or more and ended up having a mild stroke. He painted the golden eagle in a position and with a background that matched David's great painting of Napoleon on his horse crossing the Alps. That was a way of saying, look, I can paint just as well as Jacques-Louis David, but I'm going to do it with a bird.
And birds are worthy,
yes,
of the same kind of attention.
He always said if he had discovered a new eagle, a large-sized bird, he would have named it after Napoleon, because he thought of Napoleon as an eagle. Mm. I think he thought of himself as an eagle, as a matter of fact.
Oh, he thought quite well of himself, didn't he?
He did.
Well, we're talking with Richard Rhodes. His biography of John James Audubon is called John James Audubon, The Making of an American. You know, when we come back, I'd like to talk to you more about the story that we've left out, which is that he was not very successful for a long time.
Right.
We almost didn't get to know John James Audubon and maybe ourselves through him. So we'll hear more about that in a moment. Stay with us. More with Richard Rhodes ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation with author Richard Rhodes about his new biography on John James Audubon, a man who was eventually lauded as an artist and naturalist, but didn't have instant success. In fact, author Richard Rhodes told us Audubon had to leave America and go to England to find success.
You know, imagine this man. He went to England in 1826 with a portfolio of about 250 life-size watercolor penciled paintings of birds, knowing not a soul. He got off the boat, and within 2 months, he was a rock star. And by that, I mean people were asking him out to dinner. The nobility had taken him up. He had to sort of simplify himself a little bit and do Indian war whoops and owl calls.
Because he was the American.
He was the American woodsman at that point, even though he still had his heavy French accent. In these exhibition halls, he would line the walls with these brilliantly colored, wonderful drawings, with the natural leaves and plants in the background and the birds in the foreground and the human world totally receded into the distance.
Shocking was that?
Oh, people would come in a world where there were no aniline dyes, so clothing was dark and drab, and the cities of England were fouled with coal smoke, yellow air, and darkened buildings. They'd walk into a hall lined with these drawings, and it must have been like going to an IMAX theater. People were just dazzled by what they saw.
But
he still had to raise a great deal of money.
And before there was that reaction, there was despair. He was not really a young man at this point.
No, he was in his 40s by then.
And questioning whether or not, you know, you title one chapter Enthusiast or Lunatic,
yes.
You know, questioning whether he was actually the latter in thinking that he could do this, paint all the birds of America. And there's a portion of your book where you reflect that feeling.
I should just say it was one thing to be taken up by the gentry. It was another thing to raise the $2.5 million in modern dollars that this huge work eventually cost him.
Right.
And that's what he despaired about. So here he is. Before he went to bed on Thursday, he looked at his bird drawings with pleasure and yet with a considerable degree of fear that they never would be published. He felt alone and longed for America and for Lucy, his wife. Dark thoughts rolled in like bad weather. I feared thee sick, perhaps lost forever to me, and felt deathly sick myself. He went for a walk which cleared away some of the gloom, but when he returned and looked at himself in the mirror, he saw not only his own face, but such a powerful resemblance to that of my venerable father that I almost imagined it was him that I saw, a recognition that he was no longer young. He wrote a little more, large thoughts about lost opportunities, then closed his journal with determination.
It's hard to believe that John James Audubon, you know, had any moment like that, much less the many that he had, not knowing if he'd made the right decision to be this painter of birds.
Yes, well, it was a huge ambition for a man who was born illegitimate to the chambermaid in his father's house, for a man who had been somewhat disdained in Philadelphia by the wealthy and prosperous scientists there who thought he was kind of an upstart. To arrive in England and to propose to produce this enormous work was the ambition is just extraordinary. It's hard to imagine. I say at one point that doing this was like someone deciding they were going to design and build and pay for an Egyptian pyramid.
Where does Birds of America stand in ornithology?
Where it really stands is in art. I think ornithologists don't quite know what to do with it because it wasn't specifically purely a scientific work. It was, first of all, a work of art. Audubon was without question one of the great 19th century American artists, in watercolor the best until Winslow Homer. And when you combine that with his writing, I think you have an absolutely unique figure in American history. And yet the scientific side is justified, too, in this sense. There were only two Americans who were elected to the preeminent scientific society of the world, the Royal Society of London, before the Civil War. One was Benjamin Franklin. The other was John James Audubon. Mm. So he's ranked up there with Franklin in the eyes of Europeans.
Well, and in the eyes of environmentalists, he might have been the first.
Yes.
Some of the drawings that he have are the only things that we have left of certain birds that are gone.
Yeah.
And he warned of that.
He did. It's later on in life, particularly when he left Boston in the summer of 1834, had rented a schooner and had some young men from Harvard and other places as crew. They went up to Newfoundland and all those waters up there to do the seabirds while they were nesting so he could find them. And he found vast, vast slaughters going on. Mostly eggers were collecting eggs from the birds by the tons, literally the tons. So he was horrified, and he saw this as even the passenger pigeons, which existed in those days in America, quite literally in the billions, he recognized would someday be extinct, and of course now they are.
Well, and we cannot let you go without talking more about the other passion in his life, parallel with the birds, his wife Lucy.
You know, Lucy really has never had her due. She's often described as the unwilling victim of her husband's ambitions because he left her behind to support herself and their two children when he went to England.
And you remind us, it's not just you take a little boat ride. They were separated for quite a long time.
They were, and they really had trouble communicating and began miscommunicating. And for a while, across this 3 years of separation, they almost reached the point where they were going to consider separating. And Audubon had the good sense to realize he needed to get over to America and gather her up and take her back to London with him. So he jumped. He found someone to take care of his business for an entire year, which is how long it was going to take. And then he sailed to America and took the mail coach out to Pittsburgh and bought a berth on a steamboat down to Louisiana, where she was working on a school on a plantation there.
Like pursuing a bald eagle.
She didn't know he was coming, so he didn't know what his reception would be. He arrived in the middle of the night, and I could read his own words.
Please.
"It was so dark that I soon lost my way, but I cared not. I was about to rejoin my wife. I was in the woods of Louisiana. My heart was bursting with joy. Her door was ajar. Already she was dressed and sitting by her piano on which a young lady was playing. I pronounced her name gently. She saw me, and the next moment I held her in my arms. Her emotion was so great, I feared I had acted rashly. But tears relieved our hearts. Once more, we were together." They were together finally for 43 years.
And you thought this book was about birds.
Yes.
The book is called John James Audubon, The Making of an American. It's by Richard Rhodes. Thank you so much for talking to us about this incredible piece of work.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This note tomorrow on Here and Now, testing a patient's right to die or stay alive. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Spring training has sprung in leagues Grapefruit and Cactus, and San Francisco Giants slugger Barry Bonds began his 2005 campaign in an interesting fashion. On Tuesday in Arizona, Bonds, one of the major league players implicated in the Balco steroid scandal, refused to address that issue, but he did call all members of the media liars. Earlier today, Only a Game's Mitch Wortley talked baseball with ESPN's Tim Kirkchian and asked him if Bonds' press conference was a wise use of camera time.
Absolutely not. There rarely is wise use of camera time for Barry Bonds. And Mitch, I don't think he did himself any favors with some of the things he said the other day. I think he came across as arrogant. He came across as irrational at times. And even though he attempted to make some good points, I'm not sure they all came across. It looked like an angry guy who had some things he wanted to get off his chest. But in a very, very difficult time for him in baseball, I'm not sure he did anything to make himself more likable, and I'm just not sure he got all his points across as well as he would have liked. Mm.
Well, Bonds already has 703 career home runs, and surpassing Babe Ruth's 714 will likely happen fairly early in the season. What, if anything, will Major League Baseball do to celebrate that occasion?
Well, they're going to do their best to celebrate it, and I think it still should be celebrated, but it's clearly not going to be celebrated with the same vigor that it would have been if all of this other stuff hadn't come up. And the real unfortunate part about this is we are talking about the greatest player of all time, Babe Ruth, being passed on the all-time list. And then Barry Bonds, I believe, is going to pass Hank Aaron also. These should be two of the greatest moments in the history of the game. And the fact that so few people actually like this guy, and the fact that, you know, he's embroiled in such a, you know, difficult situation right now, I don't see how baseball can celebrate it, you know, the way that it deserves to be celebrated. I'm not sure Hank Aaron is going to take part in the ceremonies if that indeed happens. And it's really unfortunate for the game of baseball that this is where we are. It's a very awkward situation.
Well, Tim, just when you think the Yankees-Red Sox rivalry couldn't become any more heated, salvos were fired long before the clubs reported to spring training. Does either team stand to gain anything from that Grapefruit League bickering?
You know, I don't forget it. I mean, I love what the Red Sox did last year. That's one of the great stories in the history of the game. However, sniping this early from the Red Sox has come as a real surprise to me. I just don't understand it. Now, I'd say they don't like Alex Rodriguez. This is not the time or the place to do this when you finally won your first world championship. And frankly, it came from some guys who aren't even close to A-Rod's level when it comes to career achievements, Trout, Nixon, and some others. I'm really surprised by it. I'm slightly disappointed by it. But all it really does is add to this rivalry, which is at the all-time height. And if anybody thought that this rivalry would lose something because the Red Sox won the World Series last year, they're not watching. It's only going to get better and worse, however you want to look at it.
Can we read anything into the fact that Jorge Posada and Derek Jeter didn't exactly come to A-Rod's defense on some of those remarks that Nixon made?
Well, I think you can. I mean, I'm really, really surprised that somebody didn't just stand up and say, look, you know, A-Rod can speak for himself. You know, the guy's going to the Hall of Fame. He was the greatest shortstop anyone had ever seen for 10 years almost. And I'm shocked that they left it the way it's not my problem type of thing. And yet, interestingly, they backed Jason Giambi 100%. They said, oh, Jason's a teammate. We love him. You know, we're going to back him. We're going to support him. And they did. And yet they didn't support A-Rod. Now, clearly, he's not the most popular guy on that team. But I think somebody should have stood up and said, look, he's with us. He's a great player.
Sox and Yankees, of course, were heavy players in the free agent market during the offseason. No surprise there. But what other teams made changes likely to pay dividends this year?
Well, I think the Mets are the most improved team in baseball, and I've seen them three times this spring already. And I can tell you, Mitch, the attitude on that team is completely different than the one that I've seen in several years there, just because they've added Pedro Martinez to the top of the rotation, which they had to do. They added the best free agent player available in Carlos Beltran. They have a new manager, new general manager, a bunch of new players, and a completely new hope for this year. Now, I still don't think they're going to the playoffs, but at least they've got a competitive situation going there, an exciting team to watch, and a team that might take a little bit of the luster from the back page that the Yankees have owned now for the last three or four years.
And Red Sox fans had to be wondering what it took to get Pedro Martinez to show up a week early for spring training. He never did that with the Sox. He did it with New York.
Well, he did it because he felt like, geez, I better show the new team I really care. And so far, he's done very well.
All right, Tim, enough of this Grapefruit League intrigue. Let's talk peanuts and Cracker Jacks here. Which good old-fashioned spring training story should we be following?
Well, again, the Mets are the number one story to look at on the east coast of Florida, but I also visited the Braves, and John Smoltz is making a fascinating transition here from closer to starter. As you know, he was a great starter, became a great closer. Now he's going back to be a starter again, and nobody in the history of the game really has done it quite like this. John Smoltz is going to become the first player in the history of the game to start a major league game after saving 50 games in any season. He's doing it at a fairly, you know, advanced age, 36, but I have all the faith in the world that this guy is going to be a tremendous starting pitcher again. I wouldn't be surprised if he won 20 games this year, which means he'll be the first guy ever to win 20, then save 50, come back and win 20 again, and it will be historic whatever he does.
Let's talk a little bit about the new kid on the block. A host of problems followed the Montreal Expos to Washington. One was the lack of a television deal. Have the neophyte Nationals taken care of that problem before regular season play begins?
Well, it's not 100% done yet, but it's one of many things that the poor Nationals are trying to get ready for the start of the season. You know, this whole deal should have been done months before it was done, and therefore they're racing against time to get TV deals in place, announcers ready, the ballpark ready, everything ready, and ultimately it's going to be ready by April the 4th for their opener and April the 14th for their home opener. But they have a skeletal staff. They're still owned by Major League Baseball. They're going to be owned by Major League Baseball probably for the entire season, and it won't be until maybe even October, I'm told now, that the new owners will take over, meaning there's going to be another transition period after that where the new owners bring in their own guys. So it's very, very difficult, but people here in Washington really don't mind because they've got a Major League team, and even though it's going to be a little ragtag at the beginning, I don't think it bothers them too much.
ESPN's Tim Kirkjian speaking with Mitch Wortlieb of NPR's Only a Game and friend of Here and Now. Still to come, a gritty view of life in Iraq from American soldiers who lived in Saddam's palaces and patrolled the streets of Baghdad. You're listening to Here and Now. Imagine you've met the person of your dreams at the water cooler, and office romance blooms, followed closely by a request to sign the dotted line. Love contracts presented to workers who are dating are being used by more and more companies to fight sexual harassment lawsuits. Joining us on the line is Neil Alexander. He's an attorney in Phoenix, Arizona. And Neil, tell me first, what's a love contract?
A love contract is similar to a prenuptial agreement. In the workplace, when you've got people dating, typically involves a supervisor or maybe even a CEO or an owner of a medium-sized business that starts dating somebody directly at work. But with the sexual harassment claims that are out there, it sometimes makes upper management or investors in the company nervous that what happens if this relationship sours.
We understand some attorneys are saying that 80% of the sexual harassment lawsuits that they get arise from cases where people were legitimately dating.
I would agree. I don't know that it's quite 80%, but it is definitely a high number. Oftentimes it starts as a consensual relationship, and one person of the relationship wants it to end, and the allegations usually are that then there's retaliation or the problems in the workplace. And sometimes there's an allegation that it was never consensual to begin with, that it was harassment the entire time.
So what does the contract ask of the people who sign it?
The contract is essentially an acknowledgement that the relationship, number one, is voluntary and consensual, but it also reinforces company policies that you have harassment, anti-discrimination, and retaliation provisions, and reinforces that the employees understand that if they ever feel something's being asked of them that's improper and it's having implications at work, that they know what the resources are.
Well, and how does it get applied? I mean, does somebody think that somebody's being a little too flirtatious at the water cooler and so they approach them with a contract? I mean, how does it get implemented?
Typically, the way it arises is that you'll have perhaps a business owner of a medium-sized business who has outside investors. And there is a relationship that's developed. You've got a personal, intimate relationship, and it's other people, either owners or investors, concerned that this relationship might cause problems. They're concerned that they're not exercising good judgment. And this is one way to address that.
Well, now you're with the Littler Mendelson law firm, which has offices nationwide. How often are you seeing companies implement a love contract?
We do hundreds every year throughout the country. I personally work on probably a dozen or so a year here in Phoenix, and I think that's comparable. We have 28 offices across the country, and I think that's about the same.
And so this is a real trend. People are really doing this.
I think that sexual harassment verdicts have been on the rise for several years, and I think it's a trend, and we're seeing these contracts because you're seeing so many sexual harassment lawsuits.
And what do you tend to see, Neil, after these contracts are signed? It would seem to take a little bit of the romance out of, you know, office dating. But what are you seeing? Are these contracts leading to marriage and relationship, or are most of the contracts leading to breakups?
It's interesting. It's kind of like the same idea of a prenuptial agreement. I love you, dear, but will you sign this agreement? But it's not necessarily always the parties themselves who are the ones pressing the signing of an agreement. Sometimes, like I said, it's outside management or owners of the company. Mm. In terms of trends and what's happening, I'm not closely following relationships. I think if you talk to a lot of people, they've met their spouses at work. I think you're not going to take romance out of the workplace entirely. It's just not going to happen.
Neil, how often do you have to enforce the love contract? How often do you have to, you know, pull it out of the drawer and point out to people that they signed it?
The contract's designed to be preventative in nature, and so far we haven't had anybody challenge the contract. If they've signed it, I think the attorneys on the other side realize it will be pretty powerful evidence to a judge and jury that this was indeed a consensual relationship. And if it's consensual, there is no sexual harassment claim.
Neil Alexander is an attorney at the Littler Mendelson Phoenix, Arizona law office. Neil, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now.
This palace was built after the first Gulf War to have its wild parties.
We dropped a bomb on it, and now we party in it.
This is our party site right here. You can see where I'm putting in. I got a driver's range for golf, people that like to play golf. I'm putting in three putting greens.
A scene from Gunner Palace, a gritty new documentary that takes an unflinching look at soldiers stationed in Iraq soon after the fall of Baghdad. The soldiers are known as the Gunners, and during their 410-day tour, they lived in the bombed-out luxury palace that was the home to Saddam Hussein's son Uday. They venture out for patrols, visits to orphanages. They're part soldier, part social worker. The film is produced by former soldier Michael Tucker, who spent 2 months with the Field Artillery Division in Baghdad, and he joins us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena, California. Hello.
Hello.
And we're also joined by one of the soldiers seen in the film, Captain John Powers. Hi, Captain.
Hi.
Captain Powers, by the way, who is not in the Army currently, which is why you're speaking with filmmaker Michael Tucker. What was it like to live in that place, Captain?
It was definitely a unique experience. I mean, even though we were soldiers, we were still sort of tourists. You know, everyone sort of enjoyed being part of the palace. Unfortunately, the palace was also located in one of the most volatile sectors in the city, so it's sort of bittersweet at the same time.
Right. I have to say, I was a wreck watching, thinking, okay, here's where the roadside bomb goes off. Is that what it felt like to be there, Captain, you know, just waiting every second for something to happen?
Absolutely. Every time you drove out of the palace, you would see a bag of garbage on the side of the road, and you just sort of winced every time you passed, hoping it wouldn't explode. That anxiety was just always there.
And things did happen. Let's listen.
If it's anything like last night, it's going to be us.
When we first got here, they were waving at us. Next minute, as soon as we drive by, we'd get shot at. You know, you just get the feeling that these guys, you know, they will take your life.
Captain, again, you know, we hear soldiers talking about these IEDs or improvised explosive devices. You just referenced, you know, this fear that they were everywhere and constant fear, I'm hearing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's probably the scariest thing over there for the soldiers. They're hidden in plastic bags, cardboard boxes, even sometimes molded into concrete. One time we found one that was actually put into a dead dog on the side of the road.
And
you just never knew what was going to explode.
And as I watched your film, Michael, you were all riding around in an open truck, sitting on benches, completely exposed. It was, you know, chilling. And near the end of the film, the topic of the lack of armor on vehicles comes up. Let's listen to a soldier's thoughts on armor.
This armor was made in Iraq. It's high-quality metal. And it will probably slow down the shrapnel so that it stays in your body instead of going clean through.
And, Michael, in your film, soldiers are laughing as they talk about the armor. You know, it's sarcastic. But how serious a problem was it?
Well, I mean, first, soldiers are kind of laughing throughout the film. I think that's their coping mechanism. And the armor problem and a lot of the other equipment problems were very serious. I mean, when I watch that footage now of driving around in those high-back Humvees, as they're called, I mean, basically a pickup truck with soft skin, it almost makes me sick to my stomach thinking, like, how exposed we were and how exposed they were. I mean, some of those kids, there was one kid who was a medic. He was hit 8 times in soft-skin vehicles with, like, maybe minimal armor on the outside, and he survived every single attack. But psychologically, that's just devastating.
Yeah. Well, throughout the film, Michael, you play real scenes from what's happening in Baghdad against radio reports. For instance, in one scene, we see soldiers on the streets rounding up kids who are sniffing glue, refusing to go to school. And we're also at the same time hearing a radio report of how American soldiers are succeeding in rebuilding schools. What are you trying to say, Michael?
I'm not really sure what I'm trying to say. I mean, there's definitely a disconnect between... There's actually a disconnect with everyone. I mean, everyone has some idea of what this war is about, and then there's the reality on the ground. And the reality on the ground hasn't really seeped through. On one hand, there's a group of people who think everything's going great and reconstruction is going just fine, And on the other hand, there's people who think that the experience of the American soldier is, you know, abusing people 24/7. And I think somewhere in between that, those extremes, is the reality.
Right.
Of course, we saw the Mission Accomplished banner, things like that. And we realized on the ground that major combat was definitely not over. There is still to this day constant combat over there.
Yeah.
And the guys are doing what they can to survive and try to make Iraq a better place.
Well, Michael, in your film, you've captured the soundtrack of the war. First of all, steady arms fire, just popping off behind everything. But also, much of the music that you used came directly from the soldiers. Several pretty accomplished amateur rappers.
Hey, yo, sometimes I just stay in the zone, contemplating and praying to God that I get a chance to come home. Did you ever get to laying prone, receiving enemy fire while slugs barely missing your dome? Yo, I noticed that my face is really aging so quickly, because I seen more than your average man in his 50s. I'm 24.
Michael Tucker, your thoughts on how much rap there was in Iraq?
Soon after I arrived the first time in Baghdad, I noticed the soldiers freestyling and encouraged them to come to me, and we did some recordings. The second time I was there, we even went. There was a spoken word poet. Of course, there's Stuart Wilf, who plays his guitar in the film. Just a lot of music all around.
Well, Captain, you also became very friendly with Iraqis who worked with American forces. One, nicknamed Mike Tyson, was suspected at the end of the film of providing information to the insurgents. Was there a moment when you trusted the Iraqis more?
When we first arrived to Iraq, and there was a great amount of optimism. Saddam was gone. Reconstruction was starting off. But as we got into these situations, we began, for instance, a Mike Tyson situation, or we had the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps soldiers, and you know, occasionally we'd raid a house and find guys that worked for us during the day and then worked for the insurgency at night. Obviously harmful to the soldiers that don't know where to turn over there.
On the other hand, one of the men, the Iraqi men, he was known as Super Cop, and we find out in an epilogue, was later killed. You just knew watching this film that there was going to have to be an accounting at the end of who made it.
What we're hearing is that, I mean, Super Cop is dead. We've heard that a lot of the other interpreters, I mean, no one knows where they are. That's really a cause of concern because, I mean, for instance, there's a guy called Elvis the Great. I've been trying to find him in Baghdad and I can't find him. I mean, a lot of these guys were executed by the insurgents. During the production, both the shooting and the post-production of the film, you know, 8 people, both soldiers and Iraqis, were killed that were somehow attached to this unit or people I had filmed. And that's that leaves you feeling, I don't even think about the war politically anymore. I just think about it emotionally.
There was a sense that you begin getting watching the film that no matter what soldiers are doing, people in the States just aren't paying attention. Let's listen.
After you watch this, you're going to go get your popcorn out of the microwave and talk about what I say. And you'll forget me by the end of this.
You'll forget me by the end of this. Captain, do you think about this war in emotional terms and political terms, and do you think people are going to forget?
For soldiers on the ground, the politics of it don't really matter, the day-to-day operations. But when I came home and started to pay attention to what's being talked about in the media and how people see the war, began to notice things like last week the list of 4 soldiers killed in action was on page 22 of the Washington Post.
Hmm.
And there was a story about 50 Iraqis being killed by a suicide bomber on page 5 of the USA Today, when on the front page was a little poodle in a pink dress, which was a cover story. Americans are so disconnected to this war because previous wars they've had cousins and neighbors involved, and there was a personal connection to it. Like, my mother couldn't turn off the news. She wanted to always know what was happening. But now people can just turn it off because they're not as worried about the people connected there. Mike, I think, provides a personal connection by people able to put a face to the stories they hear now.
That's Captain John Powers, one of the soldiers featured in Michael Tucker's film Gunner Palace, and they both spoke to us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena, California. Thank you both.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm 24 now. I got 2 kids and a wife. Having visions of them pitching me a part of their life. And no, this is real life, homie, and it's just so deep. And it's so deep when you go through long weeks with no sleep.
And rap music sung by the soldiers in Gunner Palace is now being played by DJs in New York clubs. The producers hope a CD will be released this year. The film will be in theaters starting next week. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.